Blog Talk Radio.
Real Sports Talk Radio live on the air right now on the Back Sports Page Radio Network. You can contact the show by calling 760-283-0846. That's 760-283-0846. Hit us up on Twitter at my handle at RandyBSP or at Back Sports Page, backsportspage.com, of course. And also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/backsportspage or facebook.com/Real Sports Talk Radio. Big show today, 7:30 p.m. Herman Edwards joins the show to talk to me and the missing Mike Tramatazzi. He'll be on with us momentarily. We'll be partying and talking with him. He'll come up with some really good questions for Herman Edwards today. Lots of sports news, big sports news day. Plenty of NBA, plenty of Major League Baseball. Just so much going on as we welcome in the one and only Mike Tramatazzi. Michael, good evening. How are we today, my friend?
What's going on, buddy? How are things?
I'm doing okay. We're live, ready to go. Herman Edwards today at 7:30. I hope you have your A game with you today.
I'm always on my A game.
Okay, just checking. I just wanted to see what your answer was going to be
I'm on my C plus game today.
Okay. You're on your minute. I'm a minute or two behind game today, but that's okay.
Yeah. You can blame Skype for that.
Yeah. Thanks, Skype. Two thumbs up. So with that being said, like I said before, I am one of the most brokenhearted Nets fans in the history of fandom. My name is Randy Zelia, and along with one of the longest-suffering Knicks fans in the world, Mike Tramatazzi. So with that being said, there's a lot to start since we've spoke with you all last week with Kendall Gill as our guest. A lot of NBA news that's been going on. Let's rewind a little bit to go back and then move forward. And let's start with the news that Steve Kerr went to the Golden State Warriors. You and I haven't had a chance to really discuss everything that's been going on. I don't think this was a really difficult decision. Kerr is a California guy. His kids are out there. And it's a better team. And I also don't think there was a real upside for him being in New York. There's a story from the New York papers up here that Marv Albert had some influence on what Steve Kerr was doing. I don't think so at all. I think if you look at it logically, when a coach takes a job, especially in today's NBA, you have to decide what's going to be the best opportunity for you to be successful. That's why there's a lot of coaches who don't have jobs. Look, Lenny Wilkins is one of the greatest coaches in NBA history. Doesn't have a championship ring as a coach. Doesn't have a championship ring to go for it. But he's sitting home without a job right now because he's taken on so many jobs. Okay, I think he's pretty much coached for almost every team in the league. But you know, I don't think it's a bad thing that Kerr took the Golden State job.
No, but the problem is a lot of people who have an axe to grind with the Garden will just assume that, oh, Jim Dolan got in the way and didn't want to pay anybody. When has it ever been Jim Dolan's MO to not pay somebody? I mean, Jim Dolan pays people just to go away and stop being around this thing. So if he's not going to pay Steve Kerr, I mean, is there any thought that maybe, just maybe, Phil Jackson didn't want to go overboard paying a first-time coach? And the stories that come out are that he was kind of putting out that stuff well before Golden State even got involved. So if that's the case, why would Dolan have gotten involved? You know, I just think sometimes people want to just pick on Dolan because it's fun to do, but I just don't see it in this. I think it made too much sense for Kerr to go to Golden State. It's a better team. you want to say. It's in, closer to his home, and I think those things meant something to him.
Plus
his relationship with his entire
Jackson,
relationship
yeah.
with the yeah. Well, it was just Phil with the Knicks. I mean, he knows more people with Golden State.
Yeah, that's true. And I want to put a different spin on this, and you can tell me that I'm actually out of my mind if you've done it before. You'll probably do it again at some point in the next 90 minutes, and that's fine. I've been called crazy before because I said some pretty outlandish things. Like, I remember in 2002, I said that the Nets were going to beat the Lakers in the finals. I was a fan at that
Oops.
Point, so I was allowed to have blinders on. With that being said, here's a different perspective. Do you think that there's a possibility? Our friend Jose, who's been a co-host on this show for a long time, has argued the fact, and you being a Knicks fan, I want you to take your Knicks glasses off, take off your orange and blue, and put on an even-keel hat right now. Do you think it's possible that people just don't want to come to the Garden?
It's possible. It's possible. I mean, maybe it's just, some people it's not built for. I think you have to have a certain temperament and a certain attitude and
you have to have thick skin. You have to have thick skin.
Exactly. You have to be a certain type of person to handle it. And maybe some people can't. And I think that's fine. I think that's understandable. And that's okay. If people don't think they can handle it, don't be here. If Kerr's worried about the attitude of it and handling New York and the spotlight and the 50 different beat reporters and the pool reporters and the pressure that comes with it, that's fine. But let's not say it's Jim Dolan's fault just because it's the fun thing to do. And I think
I'm not saying it's Jim Dolan's
fault
at all.
I think we can pin our hats on who does.
Yeah,
his name rhymes with Lank Risola.
Well, let's welcome in a caller and let's see what they have to say. Real Sports Talk Radio. Who are we speaking
with? Hey, it's Elwood calling from Indianapolis.
Hey, Elwood, how are we doing today, buddy?
I'm doing great. Let's not talk about the Nets or the Knicks right now. Let's talk about a team that's winning. How about my Pacers? That was an awesome game the other day. Oh, it was like electric in there, and everybody had on their blue and gold and screaming, and it was great. They totally dominated. I mean, the Heat looked like a bunch of chimps out there with the basketball. It was a blast. I mean, we see now, the Pacers are a team that's built to beat the Heat, and wow, it was great. I tell you what, guys, it's good to see the Pacers come back because they had a rocky road there for a while, but I wish people would quit calling them a dumpster fire or a train wreck. Or train wrecks and dumpster fires don't make it this far into the playoffs, folks. It's like when people want to, make fun of an actor who can't act, then they win an Academy Award. No, it don't work that way. But, guys, wow, they were awesome at that game. I mean, the Heat just didn't know what to do. And the next game is in Indy, and I think they're going to cinch it, and I think they're going to go to Florida and lose one, and then I think they're going to cinch the rest of them.
Here's the problem, though, We've seen Miami bounce back before, and for Indiana to be successful for another game at home, they have to not take their foot off the gas, and that's going to be the key because they need to be constantly getting into the paint, and they need to keep Miami on their toes. Miami had 50 points in the paint, and usually that's a recipe for winning for them, and they struggled because they had a hard time keeping up with all the screens, all the rolls, and all the different changes that Indiana was making yesterday. And, Elwood, I'll ask you, were you at the game yesterday?
Oh, heck yeah. I never miss
okay.
a Pacer game nowadays. It
okay,
was
so you,
a blast.
So I'll ask you, for someone who was in that arena yesterday, was there any point where in the fourth quarter, where Miami was trying to knock it down to single digits, where you guys had all said at one time going, uh-oh, were you guys ever at that point?
No, because I honestly felt like the Pacers were so far ahead, they were laxing up a little, letting them, get a few points they maybe normally wouldn't have had because they were far ahead. No, I didn't feel that at all. I felt like they were just kind of taking a little breather, and if they got a few points out of it, fine, because they were looking at the big picture and not, you know, who's ahead at this moment in the game. No, I didn't. I mean, I wasn't worried at any point in that game. I mean, that team just dominated. You know, it was – the Pacers are just built to take down this team, and the Pacers got a lot riding on this. I think if they don't go all the way, there's going to be some mass firings. I think Vogel's out of here. I think a lot of the guys on the team are out of here. I think a lot of the people in the front office are out of here. And there's talk of Larry Bird getting fired, but let's be real. This is Indianapolis, and he's Larry Bird. Okay. So that one's iffy. But I'm just saying they got a lot riding on this, and I think they're starting to get their act together. Something internally, and I'm not going to speculate. I've heard everything from trading hose to, you know, whatever. I don't know. Not going to speculate because I don't know. But whatever their problem was, they seem to be getting their act together. So I'm not worried. The talent's there. You don't get where they are without raw talent. So if they just get their act together, keep Miami guessing, I don't see a problem. Plus, Miami's an older team, and the clock doesn't work, you know, for you when you start to get older, where when you're younger it does. And I'm hoping we've hit the plateau where the Pacers going up are above the Miami going down. You know, so we'll see. But I've seen Miami look a little less shiny every year for the past few years. And I'm not talking their garbage or anything. Less shiny, you know. So no, I'm thinking the Pacers might be the better team. And maybe this whole thing where they got a little derailed, and maybe that was good. Maybe there wasn't a bullseye on them quite as, you know. Because everyone told me I was crazy for saying they'd make it this far. You know, I was a homer and all this. I'm like, guys, this is a good team. We'll look at the Nets. We're not going to look at the Nets. Yeah, I mean, just so that's how bad it got with the Pacers. They were talking like the Nets were better, you know. But, guys, that game was a blast. I tell you, I've had that much fun in a Pacer game since it would be like Reggie Miller when they used to play the Knicks, and, you know, and he'd do the choke thing, and you're like, oh, and then somebody would hold up a sign that said, sorry, Spike. And, I mean, you know, those were the days. That's kind of what it had that vibe with.
Well, Elwood, I will tell you that on this show, you know, you said you didn't want to speculate what the problem was. Mike and I pretty much call it what it is. The problem was Andrew Bynum was in that locker room. That's what the problem was.
That could be, and I've heard that too.
And that's pretty much what it was. And I'm telling you from what I know, from what I heard from people around the league.
Me too.
We had Mitch Lawrence on this show, Mike, how long ago? We had like Mitch Lawrence 3.5 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. And we also had Bill Ingram, who covers the Houston Rockets, who's also has ears around the league too. And everyone says that was not a good fit for Roy Hibbert to have with him every single day. Andrew Bynum is not a real positive influence in the locker room. There's a reason why they told him to go home. And
yeah, I had a few buddies of mine from Philly tell me before he even came, they said, you're going to be sorry you let that jump in. So, yeah, I kind of agree with you. But then again, I hate to sit here and say that, you know, if it really was something with hose or hookers or something, they might have just went with that excuse. You know, sometimes you go with the least embarrassing reason. So I don't know. But, yeah, I'm with you. I think there's definitely some credibility to that. But I hate to sit here and state it as, you know, cold, hard fact. So, yeah, maybe that is it. Because I am seeing definite improvement in this team every game. You know, they're doing better. They're doing, you know, and guys are stepping up, and they're starting to get some cohesion. And even with Danny Granger, I think they kind of feel like we're not Danny Granger and the Pacers. We're the Pacers, you know, so maybe that's good too. You know, I know a lot of – I don't know. I just feel good about this. You know, I would love to see – I can't stand the Heat, so I would love to see them win. You know, and the media, all they got is, well, they don't want Indiana to win because who'd buy their jerseys? You know, give me a break. You know. Basketball is not like baseball. You know, it's pretty saturated. There's fans all over the country for each team. I'm not overly, you know. But it's going to be a good series, guys, either way. A lot of good teams this year, you know. And, you know, the funny part is everyone said Pacers and Miami from day one, you know. So it was just sort of, okay. It was like the year the Colts played the Saints in the Super Bowl. We all kind of said it the whole time, you know, so. Sometimes it happens exactly the way you want.
Well, Elwood, thank you very much for calling. Thanks very much for listening. Feel free to give a call back anytime. Next week, we're going to have another NBA guest on with us. This week's an NFL week. So we appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of good stuff going on in the NFL. So, yeah, you got a lot to ask him, too, there. So, yeah, it's a good sports month altogether. Sometimes
oh, definitely.
It's a dry well, and sometimes it's pretty interesting. So, okay, guys, keep up the good work, and let's go Pacers.
Thanks, Elwood. Thanks for calling in.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to be mean because now I'm talking once he's gone and he doesn't have the right to defend himself. But I don't know. I think we need to just pump the brakes a bit. I don't think one game erases the previous 13. Look, they played really, really well. But Miami was also off for a week. So, I mean, you could tell Miami was a little rusty, specifically defensively. And that was the first time Miami lost to Indiana scoring over 95 points. I think they scored 90. I think it was 107-96 was the final score. So let's see what happens tomorrow. I think if Miami comes out and Indiana has the same type of efficiency both offensively and defensively, then I think as a Pacer fan you have the right to start to feel good about your team. But I just don't think after one game where the previous team was off for a week that, you know, that one game erases the previous 13. Because for that 13, it was up, down, up, down, up, down, and some brutal losses at home specifically. So, they played really, really well. But I don't think you can really use that one game and say that it takes the place of the 13 and now you're – you know, you're back on track and you're playing well.
I'll be honest with you. You know how I feel about these series. Game ones don't mean anything to me. The series really doesn't start until game three. Because if it's either 1-1 or 2-0, when you get back to that game three, that becomes the difference maker. That's when it becomes do or die time. And if it's 2-0 and it goes up 3-0, that's when it's obviously over. But you usually learn a lot by game three. Game two is going to be fun. I think right now, you look at the Miami Heat, and from day one, from when LeBron, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade got together, I've always said their biggest challenge is going to be, from a financial standpoint, getting enough depth in the front court to support the big three, and getting a good point guard who can distribute the ball. Now, you can have a mediocre point guard and have Wade and LeBron handle the ball like they do. If they're another team and you're going to be going looking to get an asset or you're going to make a deal with Miami, you're not going out of your way to get Mario Chalmers. You're going to take Mario Chalmers as a part of a deal for another player. So that's how I feel about it. Mario Chalmers is not that point guard you're going out of the way to get. I look at the Heat right now still, inside the paint challenge, very challenged. I don't think Chris Anderson, obviously Greg Oden's not even dressing. You know, you're playing Bosch at center at times, and you're playing Udonis Haslam. I don't think, and I think that's where the Pacers really have to smarten up and take advantage of the Miami Heat, is take advantage of getting into the paint. Because it's thin down there. Now, there's going to be calls in favor of Miami when you get to the paint with, you know, LeBron and Wade. LeBron's an excellent defender. He loves doing that little weak side block of his. But, you know, I think they have to go to the paint. Yesterday they did it a lot from the three-point line. But they really, really need to attack the paint going forward. But I think if they do that, they might actually take down the Dragon in this situation and then find themselves hosting the NBA Finals. So it's going to be a really, really, really close call for this series. I'm still going with Miami in seven because Miami knows how to win that really, really, really big game on the road, and they've done it before.
Yeah, I mean, look at game six in Boston a couple of years ago. That's a prime example of Miami winning on the road.
Yeah, that is the prime example of it. Miami winning on the road, I trust Indiana maybe being able to steal one of these games in Miami, but I can picture Miami stealing two of these games in Indiana.
Yeah, I don't know if Indiana's really learned anything the last couple of years. It's that they know what it takes to play them well, but I have a hard time understanding whether or not Indiana really is turn the corner. I don't know. It's very difficult to say because, as we saw, we thought they played well in Game 6 and 7 against the Hawks, and then in Game 1 against the Wizards, they got bombed by 20 points. And you think,
yeah.
Oh, they won three straight, you know, take a 3-1 lead, and they get bombed by 30 points in Game 5. So how are they back just because they played well against the Heat, who had been off for a week? And
there's
they blitzed
no real
them in the first, and they really
no real
blitzed them in the first quarter. You know, yeah, they played well in the second half, but I really think if Miami was on kilter in that first quarter, that changes the whole game. I mean, Indiana got out to a 7-0 lead a minute into the game.
Well, that's our prediction right now for the Miami Heat and the Indiana Pacers. Real quick on the Oklahoma City Thunder series with the San Antonio Spurs. Ibaka not playing is a huge, huge, huge blow to the Thunder. I'm going to
I don't see any way. I don't see any way Oklahoma City wins without Ibaka.
I'm going Spurs in six. I think that's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fair.
I think that's solid. I think that's a solid point. I was thinking the same thing. I don't think there's any
point of even breaking it down. So.
No, I think Durant and Westbrook are good enough to win two games. You know, they're not. The Spurs aren't that much better to win it in five. So I think, you know, they're good enough where Durant can go off for, you know, 35-40 and Westbrook can go off for, you know, 25-30. So I think they can steal a game in Oklahoma City and maybe steal, like, a game five in San Antonio. But I don't see I don't think they're deep enough on the front court now to really challenge the age of the Spurs. And that's the problem that everyone has had so far, is they have one guy, but they don't have two guys. They don't have a guy they don't have a guy that Splitter and Duncan have to guard. You know, the Clippers could have been the closest thing to that if they had Griffin and Jordan, because Splitter or Duncan would have had to try to keep Jordan off the offensive glass, and that would have been a tough task for them. But right now, a Perkins-Adams combo, I'm not really sure that really makes them a problem.
And that doesn't scare me. real quick, with some of the other news around the league, we talked about the coaching situation with Steve Kerr before. What are the Knicks going to do now? Stan Van Gundy gets hired by the Detroit Pistons as their general manager and their coach. I like the move. I like Stan. This is going to be a work in progress. That team has a lot of work to do. And then the other piece of news that came out this past week, or the other two pieces of news that came out this week, Kevin Love is opting out of his contract, and he's going to be testing the free agent waters. Minnesota is going to try and make a deal. I think if the Knicks get him, that they're losing Anthony. I don't think it's going to be one of those things right now where they're going to be able to put something together that's going to totally work. All around like that. So I think that it's going to be a really tough situation for Kevin Love. I know the Celtics are interested. Listen, Minnesota's going to do what's best for Minnesota. Minnesota's not worried about Kevin Love going to a winner. They want to say, okay, you don't want to be here. That's fine. We want to make sure we get something back for you. So there's not going to be any emotion in Kevin Love leaving Minnesota as far as the Timberwolves are concerned. You don't want to be here. We need to think of our future. If we can move you and get a Rajon Rondo or something from the Celtics, or if we can make a move and get someone else that's going to help us, it doesn't affect us what you want. We have to do what's best for us. So that's the reality that Kevin Love is going to have to. And then the final thing with the NBA news roundup, as Herman Edwards is getting ready to join us in about 6 minutes, 760-283-0846. Email your questions at randy@backsportspage.com if you have any for Herman. I'll be glad to ask him on the air. We already got a couple questions that already came in. Mike, the other big news was Donald Sterling. You know, it's still going to get worse before it gets better. There's not going to be any clear-cut way that the owners are just going to be able to vote him out and he's going to go away. This is not going to go away that easily.
I think it's all bluster. I think it's all talk. If they vote him out, by the bylaws of the Constitution of the NBA, he's out. And there's no legality way he can get around this. I think it's bluster by him to threaten the league with litigation, but there's really no litigation. There's really no way this gets into a courtroom. He can't say he's been, you know, pushed out illegally when there's moral clauses and detriment to the league clauses in the contract he signs as a part of being an owner of the of an NBA franchise. So when you're given that right, you have to abide by those laws of the league constitution. And if the league constitution has ways to get you out of power, you can't go to a courtroom and say, oh, this isn't right. It's the bylaws of the league. It's like if you were a franchisee at McDonald's, you have to abide by their rules. If you don't do that, then you know they have every right to get rid of you.
You're not arguing with me, man. I'm not arguing with you.
He's a guy that wants to make a lot of noise, but I just don't see any way he makes a lot of noise. Like, I don't see where his end game is, because his end game doesn't actually exist. You know, the NBA came out today and said, oh, here's what he did, and here's how we've already initiated the process. So if they go across it, then, oh, well, that stinks for him. You know, maybe he should go on CNN again and complain and say, how did she make me say those things? Why did she? Was he reading a script?
That's the other part that I said the other day. Like, they recorded these conversations that he had with her because they used the excuse of he's 80 years old and he's forgetting about his conversations. Why would you record it? It's like, okay, well.
But the best part is, you don't need to. Because you could have just put him in front of a TV camera like Anderson Cooper did, and he was still going to say some crazy things.
Yeah, which by the way, that might have been one of the most ridiculous interviews I think I've ever watched anybody ever say.
And his wife's is just as stupid, because she's like, they're never going to take my half of the team. And then the NBA came out just quickly, and it's like, actually, if the majority owner's stake is dissolved, everyone's stake is dissolved. And it was just like a giant wah-wah to the Sterlings.
It's not only that. The other best part about it was, they're like, yeah, so remember how you were talking about how you didn't want to give up your team? Wanted to talk to you about that. That's where you're going. Meanwhile, Doc Rivers is sitting there at the desk, and they're saying, well, listen, I'm the boss right now, and I'm going to run things from a basketball standpoint the way I want to run it, and this is the way it's going to go. You know, and let's also forget about the fact, you know, from a basketball standpoint, dude, that team did very well this year. I liked where they were. Listen, I didn't think the Clippers were going to be a championship team this year. Okay,
what happens if they don't blow two double-digit leads in games 5 and 6.
They would have won the games, but they still lost those games. And the reason why is the same thing spoke about. We spoke about this with Tracy Murray. We spoke about this with some of our other insiders. The Clippers are missing a shooter. They need it. J.J. Redick is a very, very good backup player. And, you know, Jared Dudley's a nice player, but Matt Barnes is a nice player, but it's not that.
Yeah, I think the real problem is they didn't get what they thought they were going to get out of Dudley. That's what I think. I think Redick got hurt.
I think he performed pretty well. It's a mix.
But I think what you were wanting to get out of Dudley is a, you know, 15-point, 40% three-point shooter around that, and they really didn't get near that. And when Redick got hurt, they were relying on Bullock and Crawford and Barnes to really try and do that.
Yeah, but he was never that guy. That's the part that I was,
Exactly. That's the problem that they have now, is you need to find someone like that.
But we knew that going in. That was the thing that I said before. I've been saying this all season long. I said, I look at their lineup. They have such a nice foundation with Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, and Blake Griffin. I think those three are great players, but they need to have a guy who, okay, once the double teams come down or once, you know, one of them gets into foul trouble, you don't want Paul taking that final shot. Griffin's not taking that final jump shot. No one's going to let Griffin near the lane. That's just not going to happen. Listen, we're going to put this on hold. It's our special presentation featured guest of the week. Courtesy of Uppy Custom Creations. They bring fame to your name, uppycustomcreations.net. Let's welcome in the one and only, the former head coach of the New York Jets, former head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs, an outstanding human being. I wish we all had as big a heart as he has, especially for coming on this show. Let's welcome in Herman Edwards. Herm, how are you today, my friend?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing okay. You have Randy Zelli and Mike Stamatazzi here with you. So, Herm, I want to start with the draft. And I'm not going to keep going down with every team with you. I wanted to get your opinion, though, on the overall draft from this year. It started a little later. From your opinion, was the draft have a different feel this year compared to the others?
Well, I think anticipation. I mean, we are all creatures of habit, and all of a sudden 2 weeks prior to the draft, it's taken back. And I thought the league captured the May calendar. Anticipation of it, I think. I think for a lot of coaches that work on the draft as well as scouts, more time to maybe overanalyze players, which can be a detriment. I think in the long run, when you think about coaching staff and these young players, the calendar's pushed back, so it's 2 weeks later as far as getting them in there to work out. It brings training camp a lot closer for coaches and for the veteran players, but it's something that we enjoy watching. It becomes an event. When you think about all the people that watched the first day of the draft, and it was a hit.
Hey, Herm, it's Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I want to ask you this question because I know watching you coach of the Jets and coaching the Chiefs, you were a guy that really had a strong running game and believed in the running game. I mean, you guys basically rode Larry Johnson to the playoffs in, you know, six with the Chiefs. But no running backs went in the first round, and it seems to be that trend lately that people have been, and there was talk leading up to the draft, that the running back position has been devalued. As a ex-coach and someone who really believes in a strong running game, do you sense that this league is getting away from running backs, and do you think that there's still a place for needing a running back, or is the need of a running back now not a guy that can be a workhorse, but maybe more of like a LeSean McCoy, Darren Sproles type that can be a factor in the passing game as well?
Did you watch the Super Bowl?
I did. You're right.
Who won? Who won the Super Bowl? Did you watch the 49ers play?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you watch the Carolina Panthers play?
Certainly, yeah.
What do they all have in common?
Defenses and running games.
Thank you. You answered your own question.
I did.
And I think sometimes we get caught up in that. Football never changes. The one thing I do know about football, if you're going to score points, you got to throw. If you're going to win championships, you got to run. That's how it works at any level. And when you can't run the ball, not only does it hurt you at the end when you get in the playoffs and you meet good quarterbacks and you meet good defenses, but it also weakens your defense because now you can't stop the run because you play a type of offense that's not conducive to practice against your defense with a good running attack. And if you look at the teams that suffer in the playoffs and how teams are being built, because you got to remember this, guys. There are not 32 elite quarterbacks in this league. So with that being said, if you're a coach and you don't have a volume passer, I mean volume passer, that means throwing the ball 40 times a game, you have no alternative but to try to play good defense, run the football, and win that way. And most teams, when you look at them in a nutshell, when the leaves fall off the trees and it becomes cold, the teams that tackle well, the teams that run the football well, the teams that kick the ball well, they generally advance in the playoffs.
Herm, I have to ask this question to you from a different – because you have both perspectives of the draft. Can you give us a perspective from the head coaching standpoint of the draft, of the process of working with the general manager going into the draft and the draft day itself? What role does the coach have?
Well, you have to have the same philosophy. And basically, when you go out evaluating players, and that's up to the scouting staff, the coaches get involved in evaluating players. They have about a month. Now, when it's pushed back, they got about 6 weeks. So you don't have as much information as the scouts and the GMs and the pro personnel people. This is what they get paid to do. Now, it's vital that they understand the type of players you're looking for that fit in your system, because then it's easier to scout players. You know, every player doesn't fit every team. And this is why I kind of chuckle when you think about the draft, because if you're a fan of a certain team and you say, why did we draft that guy? Why didn't we draft this guy? Well, because that guy is a fit. And so it doesn't matter, you know, if another team doesn't like him. You're not drafting for 31 other teams. You're drafting for your team. That's all that matters.
Hey, Herm, a lot of talk in this area has been about Eli Manning and the Giants and their offseason of basically having to fix their offense. And a lot of people thought in the draft they were going to go offensive line because they do have some needs on there. But they went with Odell Beckham from LSU. And I kind of like the move because I think the more weapons you have for a quarterback, the better he can be. And it helps the offensive line, too, especially if those guys can get separation. What do you think of that pick? And do you think that's the guy that can contribute right away for them?
Well, I like the pick. But if you don't protect the quarterback, it doesn't matter. Unless you're playing 7-on-7, so you can't hit the quarterback. Yeah, it works real good in drills when you don't play tackle football. But when you give up 40 sacks and you turn the ball over 44 times, that's not good. That's not Giant football. And when the Giants won Super Bowls, as good as Eli Manning was, what did they do good? Answer the question.
Oh, they played.
Yeah. You know the answer.
They play defense.
Rush the quarterback.
They play defense.
So you guys are answering these questions, but then you ask silly questions about what the league's doing. Don't buy into it. Listen to your eyes. See, we don't listen to our eyes enough. In sports and in life, we don't listen to our eyes. We get caught up on the storyline. Listen to your eyes. Look at the teams that win Super Bowls. Look how they're built. It's the same story. It ain't going to change, guys. When they stop playing with pads and they said you can't tackle anymore and you can go out there in a helmet and shorts, then it's going to change. But when you have to play tackle football and you got to block people and you got to tackle, people are going to run the football. They get it. Coaches get it.
On that point, do you think that that's the problem people have with Jadeveon Clowney leading into this process? You talked about overanalyzation because of the extra part of the draft. Do you think people worry too much about what they thought about his work ethic and ignored maybe what he did his sophomore year and only focused on the quote-unquote inactivity he showed as a junior?
Well, I don't know that. I don't know if all those people watch tape of every game. And I think you can pick out games on players and say, well, he didn't play hard this time. There are players in the NFL don't always play hard for 70 snaps in a row. Look, Clowney had no upside, guys. He had no upside. He was slated as the best player in football, not on his own accord, but while people watched him, a little bit to do with our station, a little bit to do with other people, that he was the best player. He was going to be the best player in football. This is when he was in college now. So he had no upside. Anything he was going to do from that point on was going to be disappointing, because we set the expectations for this guy so high. If he didn't have 20 sacks and cause, you know, 10 fumbles, and knock the guy's helmet off every other tackle, he wasn't having a good year. So we did that. We did that. It wasn't him. Remember, there's a reason these guys are college football players. They're college football players. They're not professional football players yet. They get an opportunity now to be a professional football player.
Herman. You have a different perspective, again, because you were, again, a coach, and now you're in the media. As a coach, was it difficult at times to put, to block out the story, like you're talking to us before about the story and the media and the hype? How difficult is it as a coach sometimes to not pay attention to that and to stay on course?
Well, I kind of treat that like life, okay? Life's not a dress rehearsal. So I don't listen to what other people are saying and how they're getting dressed. I just worry about what I got to do, because I can't control all the rest of that stuff. I make my own decisions. I don't worry about anybody else, what they say or what they think. They're entitled to it. But when I have the whistle and I have the ability to make decisions, I make my decisions for the best, for the betterment of the team. I've always been that way. And people have a right to say what they want to say. That's what's great about our country. Everyone has a right to their opinion. I'm not going to say my opinion is more responsible than somebody else's. and says that my opinion is the one that counts. Okay? Because I'm the one with the whistle. And when I get the whistle, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it. I'm not going to do it the way anybody else wants to do it. And when they get the whistle, they can have
it. Okay. And the other point of that, too, is talk to us from a media perspective of the preparation that you go for. You know, there's the team aspect, like you're just saying, from when you're the coach, you have to ignore all that. But now take us to the media side, the preparation for the draft, of having to have all the information on these players. Can you talk to us what draft week is like as far as being a media member is concerned?
Well, it's fun. I mean, especially if you study tape. Now, if you don't, you know, there's two ways of studying tape. You can watch highlights, or you can really watch the tape. I prefer to watch the tape, whole game, to watch what I'm looking at, to make sure I understand, you know, skill set is, and to understand, you know, what this guy can do well and what he struggles with. And then from there, you paint the picture. You say, does this guy have his upside? Most of these players that get drafted, you feel like they have upside. In other words, they're going to get coached in the next 3 years, and then we find out if they're truly professionals or not. Because most kids struggle their first 2 years coming to the league with a lot of different things. And so I think when you've coached it and you've played it, you understand that. And you don't panic when a guy all of a sudden is not living up to the expectations everyone else has for him. And so that's just part of it. So I like that process of it.
Okay. And
Herm,
go ahead, Mike.
No, you can go, Randy. You have a follow-up. That's fine.
Herm, the other part of that too. Do you have any fun off-air stories from working at the draft? You know, with working with the guys on the NFL crew. Is there any fun off-air stories that you can share with us?
Well, I just think everyone looks at it a little bit different, and obviously, I think most of the guys that have had the honor of playing professional football or coaching it realize how difficult it is. And for the most part, guys pull for players. I mean, I've never been a guy that sat and watched a college football player and sat there and go, I wish this, I hope, you know, bad things happen to this guy. I want college football players to have success. I really do, because it helps the league. It's the lifeblood of the league, these young players. Now, you got to have patience with them, too, because if you don't, then all of a sudden, you know, they fail, and you don't want them to fail. Now, all of them aren't going to make it, and we know that going in. I mean, 257 odd players get drafted, but that's just an opportunity. I mean, you know, the longevity of a football player is about 3.6 years. So it's not about having a career. It's about having an opportunity. And so I think most of the guys that watch it, that have played it, they understand the difficulty of being a professional football player. It's very hard. There's only 1,800 of them in the whole world. That ain't many.
Hey, Herm, I want to talk about your playing career and in essence, the Super Bowl you guys went to, Super Bowl 15, as a member of the Eagles, and Dick Vermeil was your coach there, and then you were able to coach with Tony Dungy, and then you took the Jets to the playoffs as well. So you had a lot of experiences there. Tony's won a Super Bowl, and obviously Dick went and won one with the Rams. Did you learn anything maybe as a player preparing for the Super Bowl, and that maybe something you noticed that Coach Vermeil did preparing his team, and then what you saw from Tony that as you were coaching the Jets and Chiefs to the playoffs that you used, or did you kind of sum it all together and go with something you thought? How did your preparation from the playoffs as a coach and player maybe build from those two aspects?
Well, I think obviously your goal obviously is to become a world champion. It's very difficult. As we know, 90% of all the players never play in the Super Bowl. So that's a tough number. It's a very difficult number to achieve. But here again, I think the first way to get there and arrive there is you have to be a team that can get in the playoffs. You want to get in the tournament. From there, it's really a matter of trusting your players and really making things simple. Not changing things because you get in the playoffs. I've always felt when you get in the playoffs, the reason you're there is because you know what you're doing. You know, don't all of a sudden think that you got to change your identity as a team. So I always felt that, you know, you got to trust your players. They want to be trusted, and they're the reason you got there. You don't start changing things. And I just think that, you know, in playoff competition, you know you're one and done. Things are more magnified. And your true star players have to play well. They really do, because that's their time to be on stage. I mean, there's certain games that you play during the season where you're playing against a good football teams. Your star players, and this is why they're stars, they got to show up. They got to perform when the lights are the brightest. And you got to make sure that you put them in position to do that. And that's your job as a coach.
On your playing career, what do you take more Sosa, and you look back on it and maybe a little more pride in? Is it the second most interceptions in team history with 33, or is it the fact that you didn't miss a game in 9 seasons with the Eagles? Because I think that is pretty incredible when you think about how physical a game of football is, to not miss a game and be active for 135 straight games as a player. Is that maybe, when you look back at it, what you're more fond of is that you were there every game? And
obviously, being accountable to my teammates, and that's probably a unique thing about football, that you want to be trusted. You want to earn the trust of your teammates. You want to be accountable. You want to show up. You made a statement about, 32, 33 interceptions, actually 38, because there's 5 in the playoffs.
Yes.
But the number that means the most to me, obviously, is I never missed a practice. And for me, that's very important, because that's how you prepare. You know, you sign on to play football, but you sign on to practice. Because you practice more than you ever play for your whole life of football. That's how it works. And the preparation is the thing that gives you the calmness to play and to play well. Now, sometimes you don't play as well as you'd like. But it all starts with the preparation. You prepare yourself to try to play well. And it's never about you. It's really you want to play well for your team, for your teammates, because your teammates are trusting you to do that. That's what makes professional football so unique. And I think sometimes young players, when they come in the league, they think because they have a helmet and a jersey, that makes them a pro. It doesn't make you a pro. What makes you a pro is understanding that the fact that there's a lot of work involved in this. And it's before you walk into the stadium. And it's on the off season. It's all the things you have to be willing to sacrifice for the good of the team. You know, and I was built that way. So I just think my ability to show up every day and go to work, you know, every day is a different day, but every day was about preparation and trying to become a good football player.
Hey, Herm, also, I have to ask this question, too. Did you find it difficult to go through that transition of being a player into a coach?
It wasn't very difficult for me because I had aspirations of being a coach, and the fact that I wanted to give back something to the game. You know, the game of football gave me the ability to do a lot of things that probably I would have never seen or witnessed. Football was a lifeline, and it's a lifeline for a lot of guys. It gives you a great opportunity to look at life from a different point of view. And I looked at it when I was going to get out of the game of football, that I was indebted to football, that I wanted to give back the things I learned about football, the life skills, and the things I learned as a player, to give it back to the players. Because football, I've been in football all my life. I've never really had a job. It's been a game that has taught me a lot, and I wanted to make sure I gave it back. So it wasn't difficult at all. It was just a matter of if I was going to get an opportunity, and I was fortunate enough to get an opportunity by a lot of guys, a lot of coaches. I try to obviously instill that in players. You know, it's tough. It's tough going from playing to coaching, or from playing and getting on with your new life. It's a very difficult transition, but it wasn't that difficult for me because I understood that I wanted to get back to the game of football.
Can you also talk about the responsibilities of an assistant coach to a head coach in that situation. You know, what's the role of the assistant coach? What's the type of work that they do as far as reporting it to the head coach? What kind of role do they play?
Well, obviously, you give them the ability to send the message, and you have to make sure that they're coaching the same message that you're preaching every day to your football team, because they're the guys that are in the rooms. You got to be able to trust them, and you can't be in every room. They have to understand your philosophy. You know, as a head coach, you coach the coaches as well as you coach the players, and that's why your staff is critical. And you see a lot of head coaches at times, you know, it takes them a couple years to finally identify the guys they want on their staff, because sometimes it doesn't mesh well. And that's never personal. It just doesn't mesh well. So, you know, those guys are the guys in the classroom with all these guys. And you have to have the same agenda. And if you win, you know your coaches are going to get elevated, and hopefully they get an opportunity to go somewhere else, become a coordinator or head coach, because that's part of it. And I think that's a good thing. But really, you got to trust them. They got to be good teachers. You know, coaching is about teaching. There's different phases of teaching. Obviously, you teach them in the classroom, and then you got to go teach them on the grass. And then you got to hopefully they play well, because your job as an assistant coach, I've always said it, is don't allow a player to fail.
Herm, you seem like you're very old school as far as the coaching is concerned. Do you feel that social media has affected not just the NFL but the pro sports world in general in a negative way or a positive way?
Well, I think there's two ways you look at it. You know, how much you let it dictate your life. I think too much of anything is too much. I'm not a social media kind of guy. You know, I don't have a Twitter account. I don't do that stuff. But that's not saying it's not good. I think we live in a world where people want instant information right now, you know, and I want instant information, but I don't want too much information. I still like the ability to wake up every day and control my day, not letting what other people say is going to happen control it. You know, I still believe in Christmas and, you know, and all those things that I don't want to know the weather next Friday. I'm okay just with waking up tomorrow and, okay, whatever tomorrow comes, I'm going to make it a good day. I'm not going to worry about it. So that's just me. I'm built that way. You know, I'm not in a hurry. And I think when you get a little older, you realize that your memories are probably the most prized possession you ever have. And my memories of being involved in that league for that long are very satisfying to me. And I'm not in a hurry. I'm one of those guys. I'm not in a hurry. I like to look at the view. You know, I'm not driven that way. I'm very competitive to a fault, but I understand that you don't need to be in a hurry.
Can you give me your fondest coaching memory that you can remember right now? You talk about memories. Can you talk to me about your favorite moment as a head coach?
My favorite moment as a head coach is it's when players eventually come up to me in some way or form, and sometimes it's their first year, sometimes it's the third year, sometimes it's 5 years later, and they say, "Coach, you made me a better man for playing for you." That's important. That's my fondest memory.
Yeah.
And I get that from a lot of players. And that means more to me than anything.
You know, we spoke a couple years back, and we asked you during an interview when you were with the Jets, you know, about the quarterback, and you love Chad Pennington as your quarterback. Can you talk to me about the relationship you had with Chad and why it was so successful in New York?
Well, I think all coaches have to have relationships with quarterbacks. Some are more obviously deeper than others. I just think you have to be on the same wavelength. I was with Chad last week. I actually spoke at his university. University of Marshall asked me to come down there for the green and white game, and I actually spoke to the team and spoke at their banquet. You know, Chad was a guy that when I got there, he was already there. Vinny Testaverde was a starting quarterback. And I told Chad this. I said, Chad, I said, Denny's the starting quarterback. He's not going to be a quarterback controversy. I said, but what you have to do for me, you have to prepare every day like you're the starter because your turn is coming sooner than later. And I said, if you do that for me, I promise you, when it's your turn and I give you the ball, I'll never take it back. And that happened in the second year when we started off pretty bad. And then we weren't playing very well. We weren't coaching very well. We weren't playing very well. And I told Chad, now I'm going to give you the ball. And I told him, you can't lead until you start winning, so you don't have to say anything. I'll coach the team. You just go play, and you win. Well, obviously, that year we won the division after we started out 2-5. But Chad and myself, we were on the same wavelength. Chad was a leader. He was a leader. He didn't just lead the offense. He understood how to lead men. And that was the uniqueness of Chad and myself. We were on the same agenda. We thought the same going into games. He knew how I felt about certain things. So that's why our relationship, grew. And so it's been that way for a long time, and it won't change.
Do you find it difficult when you transition to broadcasting to keep the same relationships with people around the league now that you went over to the media side that you weren't on the football side?
Not at all. I get more calls from players and coaches than I did when I was coaching. Kidding me? No, not at all. Because the one thing I'm going to do is, my job is not to tell you what happened or, it's really to tell you why. It's to tell you why. And I listen to my eyes. And then from there, if I need more information, I can call players, I can call coaches. And they'll tell me why. Okay. And then I get on television and try to explain it. I'm not using television to be for a bully pulpit and to beat up players and beat up coaches. I've never seen a player or a coach go to practice and practice to lose. Players don't want to play bad. And believe it or not, coaches don't want to lose. Coaches don't call offenses or defenses because they don't think the play is going to work. I get that part. I really do. I really get that part. I've never been in a game where they call that play because it's not going to work. Or the player dropped the ball because he didn't want to catch it. It doesn't work that way. And I get it. I've been in it too long not to get it. And so when I come on, I try to tell people why so they can look at it in a different way and say, this is what happened. It wasn't done intentionally. I mean, the guy didn't mean to drop the ball. I mean, the guy didn't mean to throw an interception. Why did it happen? And most of the time it didn't happen on that play. It happened maybe 5 or 10 plays ago. What set it up? That's what I try to bring to the table. I mean, I have a wonderful platform. I have the ability to come in people's homes and talk about football. I don't take that lightly. I don't take that lightly at all. And when I talk about football, I want to make sure I'm doing it in the right way. Now, whether people like the way I say it or not, that's on them. They can judge me every way they like. But I'm going to talk about the game in the right way.
Do you find it, working with ESPN, and there's obviously, the NBC and ABC teams, being a head coach, wanting to be lured back in, do you think there's also advantage of spending the years in broadcasting being able to look around the whole entire league almost in a scouting way to go back, if you decided to go back, that you take this to your advantage? Is there advantage in that situation too?
Yeah, because you make a wonderful point. You get to look at it from a different manner. You're not involved in the race. You kind of take yourself out of the race and you look at how the league is being played. And most of the time when you study things, you study those on the off season. You just basically study your division. But it's a wonderful way to see how it's really being played out. But as we always think things change, they stay the same. They really do. I mean, rules change. New players come in. Old players retire. But it's still, it's still football. And, the rules have changed for the betterment of the game. I mean, a year ago, everyone was saying that, well, it's an offensive league, and it might be an offensive league. And if you're a defense, you can't play defense anymore because you can't tackle anybody. Well, when you watch the Super Bowl, I guess unless you were watching a different Super Bowl, you could still play defense because the best offense in captivity didn't score a lot of points.
No, they didn't. No, they didn't. Herm, we do something on this show. It's called Five Random Questions. We just ask five random questions. You're one of, like I said, one of my favorite people because I know how much you give back to charities and how much you love giving back to people, and that's what we're all about. So for you, I want to ask the first random question. What is the best charity event you've ever been to?
Ooh, best charity event, probably one of them has been to give back to the Special Olympics. I think if you have children or if you even don't have children, to watch these athletes, and I've done with the Special Olympics, it makes you walk away from there very quietly and understand how fortunate you are.
Second question, Herm, are you a better golfer or a better bowler?
Neither. I bowl with my daughters every once in a while. They're 7 and 8. We do that as a family deal, not a whole lot. I'm a pretty good golfer, not a great golfer, you know, because like golf and like any other sport, you got to practice. And I've done that practicing before, trying to be a professional football player. I'm not willing to practice enough golf to take away the time I can spend with my daughters.
Yeah. I just know that you like to go out and show support to a lot of charities by coming out to the golf events. You know, with that being said, do you have a score that you had that you're really proud of as far as golfing? Or you just, at this point,
I'm just going to score? Nah, I go play. I mean, if I play, I'm going to shoot, like, you know, anywhere between 80 and 83. Somewhere right around in there. You know, I'm not an avid golfer. I play in a bunch of tournaments. I'm here in Atlantic City playing Ron Jaworski. He's done this for 30 years already and raises a lot of money for a lot of young people. And, you know, he's another guy, teammate, and I'm supporting him. I come out and play in this deal for him. And there's a couple of other events. Obviously, the AT&T is a big charity event. I play up in Tahoe in American Century, and they do a great job of obviously giving back to charities too. So I enjoy it. I enjoy the camaraderie around being all the guys and all the athletes. So it's a lot of fun doing it.
When you're not watching football or you're not being involved with the game of football, what are you watching on television?
I watch CNN a lot, believe it or not, and the Golf Channel, but CNN. And the Golf Channel, probably. I like to know about the worldly affairs. You know, I know we live in the United States, and it's the greatest country to live in. But I like to see other countries and see what's going on in the world. You know, it kind of makes you pause and say, you know, we're really fortunate to be in this country called America. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but there's no other place I'd rather be.
And final question is, you being a member of the media, you've obviously, and being around the NFL, you've traveled around the whole league and around the whole United States. If you had to pick a state where you had your favorite food, what food is it and what city is it in?
Food, boy, that's a good one.
I wasn't meaning to challenge it, trust me.
I would probably say, I'm a barbecue guy. I like barbecue when I can get it. I thought it's some of the greatest barbecues in Kansas City. Now, I know a lot of people say it's in Texas or it's wherever else, you know, maybe in down south in Alabama or wherever. But Kansas City barbecue is pretty good. They've got some good places there that are pretty tasty. So I would say barbecue. I'm kind of a barbecue guy.
Okay, and you know, it's funny, you've been with ESPN for so long, and can you talk to us about the NFL team that you work with and what it's like to, you know, be on the air with these guys and the process? Because people tell me, you know, some people probably just think, okay, well, it's, you know, during the week you guys all just show up to do SportsCenter and you guys just show up to do the NFL shows. But can you talk about the preparation and the work that you guys actually put into doing the show? It's not an easy thing.
Well, it's no different than what you guys try to do. You have to prepare, and life is about preparation. It is about preparation and putting on a good show and giving the audience information that maybe they might get somewhere else. And so it's a lot of fun. Guys are good. We know how to push each other's buttons, which I think is a lot of fun. But at the end, we're talking about ball, and it's fun to have a platform to talk about football. And we all look at it a little bit different. You know, we come from different eras of playing football. Some guys have coached. Some guys have played. Some guys are Hall of Famers. Some guys are not. But I think we respect the game of football. We respect what coaches and players are trying to do. And we try to promote it. It's a game that has taken over our country. There's no doubt about it. It's the most popular sport that we watch anymore, and that's why we talk about it for 12 months out of the year. You know, football, it never rests. The NFL has done a great job of promoting itself, where it steals the calendar. There's a reason they pushed the draft back to May. You know, they're into May now. I mean, that's not by accident. They get it. And the NFL is big. Football is big. College football, fantasy football all of a sudden has become big, you know, for a lot of people. So I just think it's a game that that everyone loves to watch. You can't get enough information about it. I just hope that when I come on, that I can tell a story about football and make sure that the information I'm given is good information.
And it's funny to you say that, too, about the marketing of the game. It feels like with Major League Baseball, they market their history. The NBA markets their individual stars and the game on an international standpoint, and it seems like the NHL markets around their diehard fan base. Do you find it refreshing that the NFL doesn't really game around the individual players, but they market it around the actual importance of the schedule and the teams? Is that sort of a refreshing sense where the product speaks for itself?
Well, it does in this sense that they understand how to use the calendar, and everything becomes an event. You know, they made the draft an event. Okay, we know that. But they've made free agency an event, too, all of a sudden now. Now free agency becomes a big deal. I mean, the combine is an event. I mean, the combine. Think about that. They don't even play with a ball. They don't tackle anybody. They run and jump. We all sit there and wait till somebody, we want to see the 40-yard dash. It's kind of like, wow, it's like the Olympics. The Olympics in shorts. And people wait to watch the combine on television. I mean, it's just what they do. You know, the NFL has done a nice job of promoting this game. But also football is a TV game. It's built for television. And if you're a consumer, if you're a sponsor, it works out great. You know, it fits. It fits TV. It fits everything you want to come on TV. It's live action nonstop. There's offense, defense, special teams. There's movement. It's live drama. That's what it is. It's live drama. It unfolds every Sunday, Thursday, Monday, whenever they put it on TV. When they roll the ball out there, there's a favorite, and there's this shit happening, and that's happening. But it's like live drama. We think we know what's going to happen, but a lot of times we get fooled.
And my last question for you, then I'm going to let you go because I know you're busy. You know, obviously with the NFL, like you just said, it's the way things are done. It's absolutely amazing, and the NFL market is being great. If I would have told you 10 years ago that there was going to be an NFL network, would you have believed me?
Yeah, I would have believed you because it belongs to the owners. There's a reason those owners own billion-dollar football teams. They're businessmen. They get it. They get it. That doesn't – when the NFL does something, it doesn't surprise me. Not at all. Not surprising one day. I mean – They're always ahead. They're always looking 5 or 6 years down the road. Kind of like the station I work for, the worldwide leader. They get it.
Oh, yeah.
Trust me. They're ahead of everybody else. And then they don't ever look back. They never look through the rearview mirror. They're always looking through the windshield. We're going forward, boys. And if you don't get on the train, it's going to leave you. That's what the NFL's about. The NFL does the same thing, and they do a great job. They get it. It's a business. and it's a lucrative business. And, you know, it's a game that we like. I mean, it's a game that fans like. They just, because it's entertainment, it's drama. Every play, when that ball's hiked, we have no idea what's about to happen.
Thank you very much for coming on with us tonight, and I really appreciate the time you gave us. I hope you enjoy the rest of the offseason. I'm looking forward to seeing you during the regular season do your thing. You do an excellent job. And, again, I just want to thank you again for taking a few minutes tonight.
My pleasure. God bless you guys.
Thank you. Thank you. The great Herman Edwards joining us here on Real Sports Talk Radio. Really enjoyed that conversation. I thought we made him mad in the beginning. I don't know. But real quick here, we have about 20 minutes left here of showtime. Mike Tramatazzi has stepped off. And we're, you know, I'm going to be driving this ship home for the rest of the time. Really appreciated Herm coming on to talk to us. I wanted to give you guys a different feel of Herm and take you guys a little bit more off the field and into the mind of the coach Herman Edwards, the mind of the media member Herman Edwards, just so you guys can get a better feel of who he is and the different perspective of what they go through. I thought it was really, really, really good. I thought it was fun. And that was the perspective I wanted to keep. I didn't want to keep going on the field. Listen, if you want to talk about the on-the-field product of the NFL, you really can go other places like ESPN, CBS Sports, all those different places. I want to take you guys inside, behind the game, behind the microphones, and behind that. And I really thought that went well. And I thank Mike for hanging in as much as he can. He had a family obligation. I knew he wasn't going to be on for that long. So I'm going to wrap us up, you know, in about a minute or two. We're going to hang in here for until about 8:30, and then we'll wrap things up. Ryan Stearns from Beyond the Bench is going to join me for the last couple minutes here. And it'll be fun. You know, here's my perspective of what I got out of Herm. Herm is so passionate about what he does with the NFL. He's just not a color guy on ESPN. He's more than just that. He's just a great human being. And it was fun to have him on and bring a different perspective. And I'm inviting Ryan Stern. Ryan, how are you tonight, buddy?
I'm good. How are you, gentlemen, tonight?
Well, it's just me. You just missed Herman Edwards. He was on for a little while. Mike had to step off a little early, so you'll end the party with me here, as they like to say. And Herm was great. Herm, we discussed. I wanted to give a different perspective, Herman Edwards, with the inside of being in ESPN and being a media member compared to being a coach and a player. And we took that ride with him on how the process works and so on and so forth. And we also talked about the marketing of the game. And I think it's great that the NFL is able to not have to market a superstar to sell its tickets. The NBA and the NHL, because of how many games that they play, have to have different ways of marketing their product. The NFL, you can say, look, 16 games, every game matters. So,
absolutely.
You know, obviously you have those teams like Jacksonville who's struggled, and there's teams like last year, the Giants and Jets didn't make the playoffs. So when you get to game 11 or 12 and the team is underachieving, it makes it very hard, especially in cold weather cities, as you want to go out to the games. But, man, like, I wish, you know, as passionate as Herman is about the NFL, I wish we were all that passionate about some things in our lives.
And, I mean, the one great thing about, I guess, the NFL, and even in cold weather cities, is that it's not always about the game. It's about the experience. And the one thing that no sport will ever be able to touch is, I guess, the ability to be a fan, whether it be for the tailgating and the sheer, I guess, the physicality of it. When you get a big hit and it brings everyone to their feet, and when it's so much different when you have 80,000 people in the stands for a football game than whether you have 25,000 to 30,000 for a baseball game, some more, or you have 15,000 to 20,000 for a basketball or hockey game. There's just something special about having that many fans, and with it being so spread out across the country, and really, I guess in New Jersey, the New York, New Jersey area, it's the only real direct area that has two teams. So you get a lot of different, a lot of different people, a lot of different cultures, all brought in by that one franchise, and the fandom is what really, I guess, it does its own marketing. The fans do the marketing for the NFL for them.
Yeah, and I did mention to Herm that, you know, Major League Baseball markets its history. NHL markets its hardcore fan base and its superstars. The NBA markets the international market and its superstars. The NFL just markets the importance, like we were just saying, of the games and the, you know, the importance of the, you know, the product on the field. But, you know, Ryan, also on a quick other note with that is we had an opportunity also to talk to Herm about his relationship with Chad Bennington and how he was able to, you know, have a connection with him, and that connection goes on today as well. I don't think if it was for Herm Edwards, Chad Bennington ever would have gotten the opportunity. Vinny Testaverde at that time was just done. And I think you remember,
right?
He was just done at that time. Real quick, Ryan, you know, we brought up the draft to him. I didn't want to go too deep with the drafts. Mike started going a little deep with him about the running back situation. My thing to him was, did he feel like it was a little bit different set of hype over it? You were at the draft. Talk to us about being in the stands and the experience of being there this year.
It's always special when you have that one special guy, or at least one special guy. And this year you had two real special guys. You had Jadeveon Clowney, who some draft experts, if you want to put a quote-unquote, or scouts and agents, have said that he is the greatest, maybe the greatest defensive prospect that there's ever been in the draft since Lawrence Taylor. And then you have the whole Johnny Manziel thing. And not even that, then you go into day three, where there aren't normally a lot of stories, and you had the whole Will Michael Sam be drafted. So those three stories, there was a little extra buzz, especially over last year, where there weren't last year was about linemen, and linemen just aren't sexy when it comes to bringing the excitement into a crowd. This year you had quarterbacks, and you had now a whole new genre of people interested in the NFL draft with the whole Michael Sam thing. And I was real proud of the Radio City crowd, and I kind of knew that it was coming because on day three, they only announce a pick from the podium when it's going to be a special pick, whether it's going to be a quarterback or someone that there's been a great story about. And when the Rams were picking at 249 and you saw someone walk up to the podium, you knew it was going to end up being Michael Sam. I actually got a video of it. I will post it to the Beyond the Bench Facebook page this week. And the whole Radio City
You also posted it at Back Sports page one, too. That would be awesome.
Yes, absolutely. And the whole crowd started cheering, and then there was even a Michael Sam chant, and it sort of transcends sports when it's a national story. It's not just a sports story, it's a national story. And I'm glad that there wasn't some of the and you go on Twitter and there were plenty of anti-Michael Sam, not just because not the fact that he is an openly gay athlete, but the fact that people were making such a big deal over that a gay athlete is going into the draft, and it should only be about his football. but it really is a national story, and there really was a good vibe in Radio City this week. You were talking about the running backs. This was the latest that a running back had ever been taken in the NFL draft for the first time. And it wasn't even the running back who most people had on top of their boards. It was a little scat back when Bishop Sankey was drafted instead of Carlos Hyde out of Ohio State. And you're sort of seeing the feature back be phased out, and it's so many different running back by committees in the NFL now. But I really think that, especially you look at teams that have been successful going deep into playoffs, it's teams that have defenses and teams that have good running games that are able to play late into January and into February. So I do see that even though the running back isn't thought of highly as being a draftable value pick, I do see the running game start to have more of an impact than it has over the past couple of years.
Ryan, I also know that you're a hockey guru, obviously pulling for the
that
Rangers.
I am. Oh, and the Rangers just tied it up. A few seconds after Montreal takes the lead, Ryan McDonagh with a shot from the point. The Canadiens came out flying, as we all knew they would. And their coach, who is really been sort of jostling his point of view, they asked him about the play between Chris Kreider and Carey Price in the second period in Game 1. They asked him right after the game, and he said it was an accidental play, and now he comes out and he says that Chris Kreider took a run at his goalie, all because now the word is out that Carey Price is out for the rest of this series. So I really think that he's desperate to try and get a rallying cry out of this, mainly because the Rangers already do have a rallying cry, and that is the story of Martin St-Louis, who is the newest Ranger. He was only acquired at the trading deadline, but the passing of his mother, and it really has brought this team together. They've been playing inspired team hockey ever since she passed. He's been playing at such a motivated level compared to some of the play that you've seen over over the first 2 months that he's been with the team.
All right, Ryan, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to do my final point. I'm going to give my little final commentary here, unless you want to stay on for it. You can argue with me if you want afterwards. Your choice. But I just want to end off with everything here. We had a caller at the beginning of the show talk about the Indiana Pacers and the Miami Heat, and I have to be perfectly honest with you. I do think, as much as I do not like the Miami Heat as a team, I think they're great individual players, and I bet you they're very, very good people as well. I think this year for the Miami Heat, it is now officially all or nothing. Miami has everything to lose this offseason and not as much to gain. I know you can say a three-peat is everything to gain because you're gaining history. But if you lose, what happens to the Miami Heat, whether it's in the conference finals or in the NBA finals? What would happen with LeBron James? Will he opt out and decide to go back to Cleveland, Los Angeles, or New York? What will happen with Dwayne Wade and his injuries? Will he retire? Chris Bosh has been reported that he's going to opt out, and there's obviously a big check waiting from Mark Cuban in Dallas waiting for him so he can play in front of his home crowd. What will be going on with Eric Spoelstra and Ray Allen? Will Ray Allen return if the team falls in the conference finals? Or will the team just say, you know what, if we fail, let's show that we can come back and bounce back and make the right moves? at the end of the day, unlike the Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan, there was no Phil Jackson handing out a playbook in the beginning of the year saying, the final dance. We don't know what's going to happen. Right now around the league, we know that Kevin Love is leaving the Minnesota Timberwolves, if not this offseason, next offseason. It'll be very interesting to see when training camps open in October, September and October, where LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh go, if they fall to either the Indiana Pacers, Oklahoma City Thunder, or San Antonio Spurs. The one thing we do know is Kevin Durant will still be in Oklahoma City. So even though they're not saying it, this might be the last dance for the Miami Heat. Now, Ryan, I know you're still here. How do you feel about this possibly being the last dance for the Miami Heat?
I absolutely think that it could be. I think that even though there was that whole thing with LeBron with the not one, not two, blah, blah, blah. But LeBron solely went to the Miami Heat to win a championship. It was to win a championship. He now has two. He can look like, and he may go down as the all-time great when all is said and done. But imagine if he can then go to a team that hasn't won. And imagine he goes back to Cleveland or he comes to New York. Cleveland, I don't even know if they've won an NBA championship in their history. The New York Knicks haven't won since 1973. That's a New York team that has had every sort of history built into getting a player to come to them, and they still haven't won a championship in over 40 years. If LeBron James goes and does opt out and goes to New York and wins a championship, he's then going to propel himself onto an absolute different level than anybody else, because then he's going to show he is the reason that the Miami Heat won those two championships. And
I have to throw this in there, though, Ryan, and I'm going to play devil's advocate to all the LeBron lovers out there who keep on saying he's the greatest player that ever played a game, because I think he is one of the greatest players that ever laced up sneakers. I think the fact that he has such an all-around game and he's able to do so many different things, and this is where people are going to slam me and call me a hater. There's a difference between being called a hater and just being honest and telling the truth. When it comes to when the Miami Heat have a lead in the final 2 minutes of the game, LeBron James is a lot more of a confident player than he is when the game is on the line. In the final 2 minutes of the game, when the Heat are down or the Heat need a bucket, LeBron James does deliver. There's other guys on his team that are the finishers. And if you want examples, I'll give you examples. Sure, people want to say, well, game six of the finals last year, he carried the Heat. Yeah, but if you look at the final 2 minutes,
it was Ray Allen.
it was Ray Allen who hit the final shot. LeBron James bricked two threes really badly when they needed him to hit those shots. And then the rest is history. And by the time we got to the final 2 minutes of game seven, there wasn't really much of a shot for San Antonio to win. And if it keeps going right through the regular season when the game is on the line, LeBron James is not the guy who's going to hit the walk-off shot. Not the guy who's going to do it. So when people ask, you know, if I think LeBron James is one of the greatest players of all time, the answer is yes. Is he one of the greatest closers of all time? He's not even in the top 10. And that's
right, that has never been part of his game. I'm going to relate this to a little bit of a football analogy. And I know that putting these two names in the same sentence is nowhere, it shouldn't be allowed. But look at what the Giants were able to do with a healthy Brandon Jacobs. Brandon Jacobs was so physical when he was healthy, he was able to wear teams down. And at the end of the game, look who was in there. It wasn't Brandon Jacobs. It was Ahmad Bradshaw. It was Danny Ware. It was Derek Ward. Because they were the ones who were considered to be the most reliable of getting into the end zone. And like I said, I'm not trying to compare LeBron James and Brandon Jacobs because they're on two completely different levels. But I think that that's what LeBron's game is tailored to. His game is so physical and so fast, and he just plays with such tenacity that his game isn't geared to being a closer.
Ryan, I appreciate you coming on, man. We're out of time. We're in the overtime session right now. So thanks very much for coming on for a couple minutes. Beyond the Bench.
No problem.
Every Sunday from 9 to 10:30, or is it 9 or 9:30?
It's 9 to 10.
9 to 10.
And we're going to have some sound clips from the draft this past weekend that I was able to get some fan reactions. We will have those. We've also get into some NHL because we will be drawing ever so closer to the Stanley Cup Finals. We're going to have some at least one hockey guest on. For you Giants fans, we will be having someone from Giants.com to break down the Giants draft this Sunday.
Ryan, thanks very much. Everybody, we'll see you next week.